This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's been a good week. It's going to be an exciting week next week. We actually have a couple of new hires coming in, and it's going to be good. They're both really good guys. And, you know, obviously, there's going to be training phase and getting used to us and all that stuff phase and et cetera, et cetera. But these are good guys, both of them. And they're excited to be coming in, and it's just going to be, you know, my job and the rest of the team's job just to make them feel welcome and to help them step by step become successful in this. So that's going to be good. That's worth doing. It's just worth doing. So, yeah, so it's going to be an exciting couple of months here, getting everybody settled in. But I think at the end of the day, it's going to be good. So all is well there. So work is good. Was able to get some things accomplished this week. So that's good. Writing, I'm a little behind on, but that's a collusion of issues. I was going good, but I just had a few things to get finished up on the Wear It Pink Day, which is tomorrow. And so I made the command decision that even though I was 500 words down, I had 500 words to go last night. I looked at my watch and I reminded myself that I had breakfast at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I said, you know what? We're just gonna hold on this. We're just gonna hold. And so we'll have a little bit of work to do on Friday to try to get caught up. And then on Saturday, we do have another thing we have to go to. And so that's going to throw me even farther behind, but I'm a few words ahead, and, you know, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And all of it is worth doing. I do have just a few little things that are not super critical to take care of for the Wear It Pink costume. But I could make it work with what I have right now. So that's a good feeling. Tomorrow morning, got to inflate a couple of helium balloons. I'm going to inflate a few tonight just to make sure that I've got, you know, that all under control. Know where they're going to go, how they clip on, all that kind of good stuff. And then I'm going to take whatever balloons I inflate tonight that I don't use, I'm going to take them with me to breakfast tomorrow, because the young man who rents our house, Dustin, I'm going to meet him tomorrow morning for breakfast. I have already warned him that it's going to be a ridiculous outfit. And in fact, I have showed him the outfit. So not too many surprises there. But his little boy, Aiden, is coming. Aiden loves balloons. So it would be unwise of me to show up with balloons on the outfit if I didn't have balloons for him as well. So I'm gonna take some balloons for him so that he can have his own balloons to play with. But yeah, so that'll be fine. An interesting thing came up this week. I have no idea how this is going to work out. But it's just interesting. I had the idea, the nudge, the whisper, whatever you want to call it, to do something for Pink Ribbon Day in October. And as I think I've mentioned before, the initial push for it was this kind of snickering little smirk of, yeah, these guys who just wear, you know, one little tiny ribbon on their lapel and thinking, I support breast cancer awareness, you know. The not serious snickering response was, really? Do you really? So, that's what kind of started this whole thing. Well, that was months ago, months and months and months ago. I have been working on it, you know, fairly consistently ever since the angel costume was done. So, Be an Angel Day was mid-August. This is mid-October. So, it's been about a two-month build. You know, I've been puttering along, doing this, doing that, doing the other, Did I have it? Maybe. Did I have something in between there? No. No, I don't. I don't think I did. Well, I had the bear build. So I did insert that one real quick. So there was the Love People Day. That, you know, chunked a week out of there. But so it's been six weeks or so. Again, all based on one little months ago. Not really knowing anything else, but looking up and seeing that, oh, there's a Wear It Pink Day, which is even better than like a Pink Ribbon Day, because a Pink Ribbon Day is very specific. But Wear It Pink, which is tomorrow or the next day, depending on what country you're in, or maybe even the 23rd, depending on what country you're in, you know, that suggests, well, you should just wear pink. So that works, because that's more generic. And so I've been planning, got it ready, blah, 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 blah. Well, Tuesday I go out with a friend who works at Walmart. And he said, so is so-and-so, one of the store leads there, has so-and-so talked to you? And I said, no, not yet. He said, well, what's going on Saturday? And I said, well, I'm planning on coming in the store in the outfit. And he said, well, she may be calling you because the 138, which is the store I go to, the 138 has been selected to host. It's kind of like Make-A-Wish. I don't know exactly what they call it, but it's that kind of thing where I think Walmart does this for selected children, and perhaps more often it's the children of workers. And so there is a driver for the distribution center for this area. He has a daughter who has Down syndrome and who has some heart problems, and they wanted to give her a special day. And they actually selected the 138, where I go on Kearney and Glenstone, to host her. And so it's kind of a big deal for the 138 to host one of these things, that they were selected to do this. And so the person who's in charge of it has been working to get signs together and balloons. And, you know, they asked the little girl, well, what are your favorite things in the world? And as it turns out, her favorite color is pink, and her favorite things are princesses, which is that's pretty predictable. And we've talked about that a couple of weeks ago. So I did talk to the manager. She got in touch with me this week and said, hey, give me a call when you have a chance. And so I called her, and, you know, we chatted, and she was ramping me up to, like, be the grand marshal for this parade that they're going to take her out around. And I said, I'm more than happy to do that, but you haven't seen the outfit yet. I said, so let's do this. Let's do this. I will come and see you. I'll be in the store Friday. I'll find you. We'll talk. Because my concern is, I would guess that the little girl is going to like it because it's very pink. And there's balloons and there's, you know, so it's very pink. And so I would guess she would like it. But the question is, how are the parents going to react? And so this experience is not only for the little girl, it's for the parents as well. And if I am doing something in an official capacity, then that stands the chance of washing back unkindly on Walmart, because you just never know. With guys, you just never know. Some guys are okay with all of this. Some guys are not. And so if Dad happens to be one of those guys, which is not okay with it, which is fine. Everybody gets to have their own opinions on things. It's going to be much better if I am a kind of a flyby and, hey, how you doing? Happy Wear It Pink Day. You know, good to see you all. Chit-chat a little bit and out. It's going to be much better for me to do that than to have, you know, have to have Dad parade around the store with me. So that's what I'm going to propose tomorrow. I'm just going to hang around the store a little longer than I normally would. And, you know, shoot the breeze with people and do that. And, you know, then when the time comes and the parade comes through, I'll say hello. And if the little girl's eyes light up and the dad laughs and, you know, it seems like it's okay, then, you know, we'll participate. So we'll see how that goes. But it's very interesting. You know, it's very interesting. that they're going to have a pink balloons and they're going to have pink. I mean, so I will be right in costume for this whole thing. It's very interesting. So fun stuff. We'll see how that goes. I'll let you know next week. We do have small groups coming over tonight. And in fact, we're doing a cookout. And there's lots of stuff going on, and I've got to get home and do some vacuuming, and I've got to get a fire built, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So things to do. But I did come across an excerpt off of a Lex Fridman podcast that I thought was very, very interesting. So it's a YouTube video entitled Human Civilization is Facing a Meaning Crisis. And it's John Vernacki and Lex Fridman. And this guy does studies, psychology, I think it's sociology, studies in the mind, studies. They've studied, you know, things. And he started, when Lex Fridman asked him about all of this, he started out by saying, I've argued that the very processes that make us adaptively intelligent subject us to perennial problems of self-deception and self-destruction. So creating for ourselves and for other people all of that, and it can cause an existential anxiety. It can cause despair. It can cause a sense of absurdity across historical periods. And human beings have come with ecologies of practices. There's no one practice. There's no panacea. I would disagree with that, but that's okay. For some reason, I have the hiccups. So they've come up with ecologies of practices for ameliorating that self-deception and enhancing the fittedness, that connectedness that's at the core of the meaning of life. That we prototypically called wisdom. And so this is where I kind of perked up my ears. Because first of all, he's describing the activity of the flesh. That's what he's describing. So, and he gave as an example our paucity of wisdom in the world by saying, he said, I will ask my students, sorry, I'm weaving a little bit on the road so there is noise. He said, I will ask my students, where do you go for information? And he said, they'll hold up their phones. Where do you go for knowledge? And he said, you know, they'll do that a bit more slowly. And probably because they're in my class, they'll say, well, science, the university, I'll say, where do you go for wisdom? And he said, there's silence. He says, the problem is that wisdom isn't optional. That's why it's a perennial, cross-cultural, cross-historical, because of the perennial problems we have, do not have homes for ecologies of practice that fit into our scientific, technological worldview. So that they are considered legitimate, the fastest growing demographic are the nuns. Basically, they don't have any religious alliance. And they will say, well, I'm spiritual. I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. And so there's this kind of amorphous thing. I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. He said, what's interesting is he said, if you look back in the Neoplatonic tradition before the scientific revolution, the idea of science and investigation and belief in God, he said, there was no opposition in any of that. It was all interwoven together. And in fact, he said, we do research. He said one of his RAs did research to find out who are the people who are interested in cultivating wisdom. And he said, when you look at people within religious traditions, and the people who are doing it with a purely secular framework, by many measures that they try to study wisdom scientifically, the people in religious paths do better than secular. But according to him, the important part is there's no significant difference between religious paths. Now, I don't know what they're trying to measure. Obviously, there's a lot of things that you can measure when you're trying to figure out what is quote-unquote wisdom. So there can be a lot of permutations off of that. But he did very definitely say that there are mechanisms in religion, in religious thought, that are assistive mechanisms that outperform other mechanisms of just trying to find wisdom in our scientific engagements. And so, of course, Lex Fridman was asking him, well, you know, don't you think that we can find this just by, you know, what we study and that kind of thing? And he said, no, he said there are mechanisms happening inside religious systems of thought that are actually, what did he call it? He said that are actually, he had a term for it. It wasn't awareness, just as there. He said what's called 4E cognitive science, the kind of science I practice, there's a lot of converging evidence for different ways of knowing. So then he started talking about the different ways of knowing, and this was pretty interesting. Because from what he said, these different ways of knowing, they actually exist in different parts of the brain, and there's surface level stuff, and then there's other stuff that goes deeper and deeper and deeper, and he feels like the religious systems are actually addressing those ways of knowing, which are very, very deep within us. And that is what causes this difference. I should have rolled up the window when I was driving around. Sorry, I've noticed that if I don't have the window rolled up and I'm driving around, the wind comes in and sometimes I get little, so sorry about that. I try to remember. So anyways, he said, first of all, there's procedural knowing. And that's simply knowing how to do something. This is skills and not theories. They're not beliefs. They're not true or false. They engage in the world or they don't, and they are stored in a different kind of memory. And then there's perspectival knowing. This is knowing what it's like to be you here now in this situation, in the state of mind. You know, the whole field of salience landscaping. What's it like to be you here and now? And you have a specific kind of memory around that. It's like episodic memory. And he said that knowing, he used a couple of terms I had not heard before. He said that kind of knowing is connected more to adverbial qualia than objective qualia. So it's not just the green grass, but it's what I'm feeling when I'm seeing that green grass. And then there's another one he called participatory knowing, is the idea that you and the world are co-participating in such things, that the real affordances exist between you. So both me and this environment are shaped by gravity, and the affordance of walking becomes available both to me and a lot of this environment are shaped by my bio. So it's that this participatory knowing is, it's not just facts, it's our experiences as we move through the world. This is participant, and the sense of it comes with a sense of belonging at every level. So the ability to walk is a kind of knowledge. And there's this dance between physics that enables this process, and just participating in the process is the act of knowing. And there's a really weird form of memory that you have for this kind of knowing. It's called yourself. And so he says, so you have all within you your identity as a self, and you have all of these kind of roles that are somehow contributing to that identity, but are not equivalent to that identity. So there's precipitory. So he's saying with all these levels of knowing, there's something functioning in religions that is transforming people and making them wiser. Just a second. I should take this call. I'll be right back. Okay, sorry about that. That is the young man I'm going to have breakfast with tomorrow. And I knew he had just gotten out from having a little interview with some people, so I wanted to get caught up. Anyways, so yeah, there's all these different types of knowing. It's interesting because they got into talking about Nietzsche, which a lot of these conversations eventually devolve into Nietzsche. He says, so when the madman in Nietzsche's text goes into the marketplace, who he's talking to, he's not talking to the believers, he's talking to the atheist, and he says, you do not realize what we have done. We have taken a sponge and wiped away the sky. We are now forever falling. We are forever falling. We are unchained for the sun. We have to become worthy of this. And he said, well, Nietzsche is full of romantic words, but that was the objection Lex Friedman was giving. And the guy said, no. He said, the point here is, yes, there is a point that there's one thing to rejecting the proposition. There's another project of replacing the functionality we lost when we rejected the religion. So it's interesting to hear someone who is not a believer, who has recognized from investigations that that there is something that's lacking now when we have taken out religion. And he attributes it to the fact that religion was developed over time, you know, through an evolutionary process and performed a function. And now, you know, we've thought. So what he's trying to do is he's trying to find what is that functionality, you know, without having to buy into propositional sets of legacy religions. So that's what he's trying. So he gave a couple examples of people who are trying to do that, et cetera, et cetera. And my response to them is, you know, well, good luck with that. So let's just see how that works out, because we'll see. Anyways, I got to go vacuum some rugs and like that. And then I got to see if I can get a fire started. And there's more to come. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.